Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from the newsroom of PCJ Radio International. One of two options for Bougainvillians when they vote in next year in an independent referendum for greater autonomy, the referendum is a culmination of the 2001 Bougainville Peace Agreement, followed by a 10-year civil war. At a meeting in Port Moresby last week, the leaders of Bougainville and Papua New Guinea agreed the question to be put on the Bougainvillian, to the Bougainvillian people, that is, do you agree for Bougainville to have number one, greater autonomy, or number two, independence? The University of Wollongong professor of politics, Tom Wolfers, has long been involved in Bougainville issues and was at the meeting. Don Wiseman asked him about the greater autonomy and what it means.
At the bottom line, it means nothing less than a practical, actual version of what's in place now. I mean, one of the difficulties has been that the existing autonomy arrangement has probably not been developed as far as it might be. And I think the referendum process is that first the people vote, but then the governments consult before it goes to the national parliament. And at the level of the consultation, one assumes that there will be a discussion about what is the way forward, what is the greater autonomy that we can agree to. And as you look around the world, there are all sorts of relationships which might provide possible models or at least guidance in making the decision.
When the people of Bougainville go to vote, they're going to have some idea of what this greater autonomy means.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, there's been a proposal on the books for a long time that there needs to be a political dialogue at the national level in Bougainville and between the two of them about what the future might hold and even what independence means. But that dialogue hasn't taken place. And I think that's one of the challenges that has to be addressed if people are going to make meaningful decisions. But I think the bottom line, if you like, in arriving at that wording was simply to make sure that it wasn't something less than what is the present arrangement is. But it is undefined.
What are some of the possibilities that could be put in front of the people of Bougainville as to just what greater autonomy could mean?
Well, firstly, it could mean a more effective, more complete implementation of the present arrangement. It could also mean that you sit down and talk about the particular issues that can't be transferred and define them and leave most others then to the autonomous government. So you might say, well, there's agreement that we will share a currency, for example, or there will or won't be freedom of movement between Bougainville and the rest of the country. There's all these sorts of issues to be looked at. Should Bougainville remain part of the jurisdiction of the University of Papua New Guinea, or should it have to look at the cost of that itself? And obviously, a major issue, whether it's independence or a greater degree of autonomy, is going to be to look at things like the cost of defence that might be required or various policing arrangements and so on. These are issues that have not been addressed in any detail, but clearly have to be, both in defining independence and greater autonomy.
Well, could they have their own police force and their own army?
Well, up to a point, they already have their own police. There is a Bougainville police, but it's really in some ways part of the Papua New Guinea police force. When you look at things like their own armies, there's the sheer question of cost involved, and it's hard to imagine that an autonomous Bougainville government in the reasonably foreseeable future would want to or be able to address the costs of that.
Papua New Guinea civil society organizations say the logging industry is robbing the country of hundreds of millions of kina every year. A civil society spokesman cites two reports which allege the progressive, deliberate, and continued acts of tax evasion by foreign-owned mining and logging companies operating in PNG. Melvin Lavango reports from Port Moresby.
The Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative Report 2016 and the Auckland Institute Report 2018 confirmed that huge increases in mining and logging have not seen a matching increase in tax revenue. A civil society spokesperson, Priscilla Carra, says both reports confirm tax evasion amounting to hundreds of millions of kina every year, which is money lost to PNG economy.
The income derived in turn for Papua New Guinea is minimal, insignificant, and totally disproportionate to the total value of raw exports that leave our shores.
Ms. Karras says logging and mining's largest contribution to national income is from tax on wages, a third of which is paid by employees. PNG corporate income tax rate is 30% for local companies and 48% for foreign-owned ones operating in the country. The Auckland Institute is a progressive U.S. think tank which subtitled its report, The Great Timber Haste Continued. Its Hata Frederick Mosau says despite PNG becoming the world's largest exporter of tropical timber, it is losing tax revenue through various forms of avoidance by the almost entirely foreign-owned and controlled industry.
For several years, exports between 3 million and 4 million cubic meter every year by these logging companies, mostly going to China. And these companies were plundering Papua New Guinea and making people destitute and dispossess of their own land and resources are not even contributing to the public revenue and to the economy of the country.
Mr. Mosau says the industry convinces many people it is operating for the benefit of the country, but he says the increase in logging exports has largely been made possible by illegally granted special agriculture and business leases, or SABLs. An anti-corruption activist, Pamela Awusi, highlights what she calls the fraudulent land grabs in her area of West Pomeo.
The landowners left suffering. Their land was taken away from them for 99 years without their consent, and to get their land back, they're still battling this in court.
The executive director of PNG's Institute of National Affairs, Paul Barker, says illegality in logging is nothing new. He says legislation was introduced in the late 1970s to empower the landowners and encourage sustainable forest management that would produce ongoing revenue for PNG and its people. But 30 years on, and he says corruption reigns.
We constantly see the power and that growing power of the industry to have very strong influence, sometimes in the highest places, to circumvent the efforts to be able to manage the industry responsibly, accountably, for, as I say, the landowner's best interests.
PNG civil society spokesperson Priscilla Karras says they are petitioning the government for action. She cites Malaysian Rimbunan Hijau, which has doubled its financial loss over 6 years while increasing its exports by 40%, as the worst offender. Civil society is calling on the Prime Minister and the National Executive Council, the Internal Revenue Commission, and other state agencies to treat this matter with great concern and urgency. This is Melvin Levongo.
Members of the Vanuatu Community Parole Board are in New Zealand for a week of professional development. Vanuatu is one of the few Pacific jurisdictions with a functioning probation and parole operation. Its parole board was set up in 2006 with help from New Zealand as part of a long-running partnership with Vanuatu to establish its correction system. Johnny Blades reports.
The visit by the Vanuatu board is the first step in a Pacific engagement program initiated by the New Zealand Parole Board. The New Zealand Board's chairman, Sir Ron Young, has extensive experience conducting judicial training in the Pacific and sitting as a judge of both the Solomon Islands and Vanuatu Courts of Appeal. He says this week's program is a capacity-building exercise and offers an exchange of ideas about how the two countries' respective parole systems work.
I wouldn't be telling them what to do, but I would be inviting them to consider such things as giving more detailed reasoning in their decision-making. Now, that can be a burden for them, but it is important that prisoners know why they have or haven't got parole, and it's very important for the community to know why people have or haven't got parole, the reasoning behind it, more than just the decision.
Vanuatu's parole board includes members of the judiciary and correctional services, as well as people who are customary chiefs in their local community. This interface is something which other countries can learn from, according to Chris King from New Zealand's parole board. He suggests the role of chiefs is a key asset for Vanuatu's system.
In terms of being able to see offenders in their communities and who they are accountable to, I think that's really important, and also I think in terms of victims being supported very clearly within a very specific context is something that is, I think, Vanuatu leads the way on in some ways.
The training in Wellington offers the Vanuatu Board insights into how New Zealand manages a much larger number of cases. Vanuatu's board is chaired by Justice Oliver Sacksack, who says they are relishing the opportunity to closely observe how New Zealand's board reaches its decisions.
And we're looking forward to see how the New Zealand Parole Board deals with information that is necessary to assist the Parole Board to make right decisions, fair decisions that are appropriate, not only for the public at large, but also for the parolee or the offender.
Justice Sacksack says one of Vanuatu's main challenges is to ensure involvement of victims.
At times, the victims are not in the actual hearing. They're not consulted. And when parole board takes decision in their absence, they would hear about it at some later time and there would be some cause of complaints.
Justice Sacksack says another challenge is the lack of resources for the parole board. He says he'd like to see more resourcing so the board's chair can become a full-time position, allowing it to consider applications as they emerge. That way, he says people wouldn't be languishing in detention for longer than necessary. This is Johnny Blades.
Japan's foreign minister has recently visited New Zealand and raised concerns about high levels of debt in the Pacific Island nations. New Zealand's foreign minister, Wilson Peters, says the two countries are teaming up to ensure Pacific aid development is more efficient and less hampered by bureaucracy. Dr. Ann Prowles is a senior lecturer at the Security Studies at Massey University, and she spoke to Jenny Meyer about how she sees the close link between the two countries and what might it mean for the Pacific.
What was not surprising in many respects, given the broader geostrategic discussions at present, was the foreign minister kind of made reference to concerns about increasing debt distress amongst some Pacific Island countries. And although he didn't specifically mention China or name China, that was certainly the inference. And Japan has been increasingly vocal about its concerns in regards to Chinese engagement in the Pacific Islands region, although again has always been very careful about not naming China as such, but certainly this year we have seen increasing Japanese engagement on areas such as maritime security architecture and also the Trilateral Partnership for Infrastructure Investment, which was announced in July this year between Japan, the US and Australia, which is very much seen as a means for countering the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. And of course, the Pacific Island countries are part of that broader Indo-Pacific strategy.
It sounded like both the foreign minister from Japan and Winston Peters were really wanting to emphasise some sort of a link or even a new alliance to become more efficient with aid projects and development in the Pacific. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, Japan has always been a key development partner in the region and has also maintained strong multilateral ties, hosting the Palm Summit, which is Japan and a number of the Pacific Island countries, 17 Pacific Island countries. And Japan hosts that on a regular basis. And so it always has been very engaged on Pacific issues, particularly in development and fisheries and so forth. So it's not surprising that we're seeing this. Japan has obviously got vested interest in strengthening its relationship with other countries, such as New Zealand, Australia, France and others in the region as like-minded partners. Again, the backdrop of this is the geostrategic competition with China, but also uncertainty about the US's role in the region too. So what we are seeing here is a positive development, and certainly from a development coordination perspective, what we're seeing here is a positive, you know, move towards greater coordination in the development space between New Zealand and Japan and broadening that out to include Australia and other countries, other donor countries engaged in the region. But what is fundamental here and what I'm wanting to see in these announcements out over the past 8 months or so around increased Japanese involvement is to get a sense of where the Pacific voices and leadership is. And so far, I'm not seeing that.
So are you worried that the Pacific is really perhaps being played a bit here?
Not suggesting it's being played, but I would suggest that there's an awful lot of conversations going on the periphery around influence in the region. And more work needs to be done to ensure that Pacific Island priorities and voices and agendas are supported and not ignored, but certainly not necessarily taken into account as this push for around geostrategic influence increases in the region.
Mr. Peters talked about keeping the peace in the Pacific. Obviously, the Pacific means peace. And the foreign minister from Japan talked about New Zealand's help with Japan in terms of the South China Sea and the Korean Peninsula. How relevant is that in terms of driving what Japan wants from New Zealand?
Oh, very relevant, absolutely. But the flip side to that as well is keeping in mind that there's a strong theme and push for an anti-militarization push within the Pacific Islands itself. And so how that is balanced is going to be of extreme importance. And there's a real tension there between the concerns that are being raised in regards to the South China Sea and the Korean Peninsula and concerns around potential increased Chinese military engagement in the region, but also the strong push amongst Pacific Island countries for demilitarization and non-alignment. So there's a real tension there between the two. It's going to be quite critical that New Zealand is able to balance those tensions going forward in both its relationships with the Pacific Island countries, but also in its relationship with partners such as Japan.
Just finally, what do you think's the take-home message from the current situation with New Zealand in relation to Japan and how that impacts on the Pacific countries? Is this good for the Pacific?
Absolutely. I think it's good for the Pacific because it means more conversations and more discussions about better coordination, about more coherent coordination, as long as it is also in the interest of the Pacific Island countries themselves. And the Japanese Foreign Minister made the statement that the Pacific region was important in a strategic sense to both Japan and New Zealand. Arguably, the Pacific is important in other ways to New Zealand because it's our neighbourhood, because we have an invested relationship, a family relationship in many respects with our Pacific Island neighbours. So we cannot lose sight of that as well, in addition to the strategic imperatives.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, which comes to you weekly from the newsroom of PCJ Radio International. The author of a new book about the impacts of climate change on coastlines says the sea level is rising more in the Pacific than other regions. Neville Pett last week launched his book, The Invading Sea, which looks at the adaptation of climate change impacts in New Zealand and several Pacific Island Atoll territories. He describes the book as a call to action from government, initially New Zealand's online climate adaptation and migratory of greenhouse gases. He spoke to Johnny Blades.
The sea level is rising, and it's rising in the South Pacific more than it is in other parts of the world, and it's not such an even thing around the world. So there's that happening. Plus, as the ocean absorbs the atmospheric warming, you get more evaporation. You get two things happening: more energy and more likelihood of cyclones developing, and then you get the cyclones are carrying this extra water vapor. Water vapor is itself a greenhouse gas, so you get that feedback. It's compounding on already a problem issue.
Does that make them more intense?
Yeah, the intensity as well as the frequency increases, and the water, the capacity of them to carry rainwater increases as well.
Are you sure about the frequency increasing? Because we have James Rennick up here at Victoria University saying that it hasn't necessarily affected more, given rise to more cyclones, just that they're more intense in their severity.
Yeah, there's that too, but if, I mean, I know you can't just go on 1 year's occurrence of cyclones or hurricanes, but just look at the hurricane hitting Florida now. It's only a couple of weeks since a similar one, maybe less intense, but nonetheless damaging because of the amount of water it's carrying. hit North Carolina.
Your book obviously looks at coastlines, coasts. Would you say there's every affected atoll in the Pacific? You couldn't say one thing that applies to all of them in terms of the impacts of the sea level rise on them?
Well, they're all going to feel it in the future. Whether we reduce greenhouse gas emissions to zero, even if we do that, there's going to be decades, generations of sea level rise ahead of us. I know we're talking small numbers right at this moment, but 3.5 millimetres per year doesn't sound like much. But it's all compounding, and if you add in the element of increased storminess, you know, whether it's more intense or maybe not more frequent, but certainly more intense cyclones, then you get real trouble. You get double trouble.
And isn't the whole makeup of these atolls is eroding or is being acidified and so forth as well at the same time? Isn't that part of the general, you know, wear and tear that they're going through with the climate change impact?
Yeah, that's right. The acidification of the ocean is increasing, that's true, and causing changes in the marine biodiversity. Therefore, you know, changes in the food webs at sea and in the fisheries, you know, yield as well, I think. I think the island states are quite right to call on the rest of the world to help them, limit the increase in global warming to a maximum of 1.5. That's not a target. That is, you know, once we go over that, we're getting into the 2-degree range, and after that, runaway climate change is possible.
Mm. Cataclysmic.
Yes.
Your book also obviously looks at people and how they cope with this, how they've been coping, and what would you say about how Pacific Islanders have been responding to this stuff?
Oh, well, they've had hundreds of years of issues, you know, sometimes with storms. I'm familiar with some islands like Tokelau, which have, you know, the people there have been wiped out by a cyclone in the past, and other atolls, states and territories have had that happen to them as well, and they've had to move away. And I just think they have a history of resilience, and they are very resilient people from my experience of them as well. But there is a limit to what can be sustaining life, human life, on these atolls that are maybe, you know, it's not so much the acidification that I would worry about, but the salination of the freshwater supply, the lens underneath the atoll itself that may be getting more saline and therefore affecting the crops and affecting the water supply for the people.
And your book also covers how Tokelau has gone 100% renewable energy. Is that quite unusual across the Pacific?
I think it's a feature of the way New Zealand is supporting the Tokelau over there and has done for the time. I was there first in about the 1980s for two visits and saw, you know, what was happening there. Already there was a start to, there was development going on which was helping them to survive in the modern world. But now they've really upped the game in terms of energy self-sufficiency, and the big photovoltaic arrays up there now are really providing all the energy they need.
Do you think other Pacific countries will follow suit? Of course, Tokelau is relatively small, so maybe it's easier.
Yeah, certainly easier, and New Zealand is the mothership for funding. Whereas other states are, you know, some of them are independent, of course, now. Most of them probably are. So, you know, they have to look around for funding for renewable energy projects themselves. And it's not always that easy to find that funding.
Everyone, in a way, is talking about climate change, but talk is sometimes rather empty. Where does this book fit into it all?
Yeah, well, I've written it because I wanted just to add my voice to the call for action on the part of the so-called developed countries that need to very soon, and, you know, within the next few years, reduce their carbon reliance on carbon fossil fuels. and the emissions. We simply have got to do it. New Zealand can say, you know, oh, we're only a small component of the international effort that can be made on this issue. But if we can't lead the way, who can? I mean, we've got the capacity to do it.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's pcjmedia@gmail.com. Once again, pcjmedia@gmail.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Palmer, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you in 7 days' time. Bye-bye.